The 100 Years War, the Wat Tyler Revolt, Part 2. Now, Tyler first led his horde south through Kent towards the coast. The most serious incidents occurred at Canterbury, where some 4,000 rebels entered the town, looking for Archbishop Sudbury. As Chancellor of England, he was a convenient scapegoat for the failures of the ministry. Sudbury, fortunately, was away in London, but the crowd sacked his palace and invaded the cathedral, threatening him with the traitor's death when they found him. Ah, this Chancellor shall give us an account of the revenues of England and the great profits that he has gathered since the king's coronation. They cried, according to Froissart's informants, when they saw the luxurious decorations of the archbishop's palace. They then went to occupy the castle and break open the town jail. In the streets of the town, the sudden collapse brought opportunities to settle old grudges. "Have you no traitors here?" the crowd yelled as they passed through the streets. Houses were pointed out, and their occupants dragged into their streets and their heads hacked off on the ground. Over the following days, mobs moved through Essex, Kent, gathering strength as they went. They were armed with sticks, battle axes, rusty swords, half-plumed arrows, and bows riddened with age and smoke. In general, their targets were carefully selected. The rebels were interested mainly in the destruction of documents. The county records kept in Canterbury Castle, the reminiscences of the sheriffs of Essex and Kent were kept in their homes, judicial and financial records of every description. Documents sealed in green wax, the color used by the Exchequer, were specially singled out for destruction as they were assumed to be related to taxes. They attacked the manors and the urban mansions of the sheriffs and the royal officials, the king's judges and the justices of the peace, lawyers, and poll tax commissioners. Anyone connected with the crown or John of Gaunt was vulnerable. The perpetrators of these acts were not drawn from the poorest and most desperate sections of the community. Some of them included many of the ringleaders were people of substance in a village scale, who held office in manors as reeves, bailiffs, and constables. Some were free tenants with large holdings of land and beasts. Such men must have found it relatively easy to pay the poll tax, but they came from the very groups of successful rural entrepreneurs who had found the constraints of the manorial courts and the intrusions of the royal officials most irksome. They also represented the most politically informed sections of the village society. On about June the 10th, 1381, Tyler resolved upon a coordinated march on the capital by rebel forces from Essex and Kent. Tyler himself took command of the men of Kent who approached the city from the south. On his march, he was joined by a man who'd rather more is known, John Ball, the Mad Priest of Kent. Ball belonged to the persuasive clerical underworld which flourished throughout England in the late Middle Ages and gave a large number of local leaders to the revolt of the 1381. He was an ordained priest, an itinerant preacher who had been spreading his heterodox message for some 20 years, and he was currently languishing in Maidstone Jail. The rebels found him there and forcibly released him. Ball was not an organizer. He was an ideologue, a prophet, and a seer. His traditional target had been the wealth and corruption of the higher clergy. But under the impulsion of events of June 1381, he broadened his theme to embrace an intense messianic utopianism, which ultimately rejected all political authority, lay and ecclesiastical. In a series of broadsheets which were widely distributed across England, he denounced, in obscure and elusive rhyming couplets, the sinfulness of power. The most famous statement of his views was the sermon that he preached to the rebels of Kent on Blackheath, on the text, "When Adam delved and Eve span, who was then the gentleman?" God had made all men free, said Ball, but men had fashioned the bonds which now held them. Once oppressive lords, corrupt judges, and dishonest ministers had been removed, all would be free, and all would have the same nobility, rank, and power. What Ball seems to have meant by this was that there would be no intermediaries between the king and the masses of peasants, laborers, and craftsmen. His program was summed up in the slogan, quote, "With King Richard and the true commons of England, it became the watchword of the revolution." When the rebels began their double march on London, the king was at Windsor. On June the 11th, 1381, he was brought to London and taken to the Tower, which is thought to be the safest refuge in southern England. He was joined there over the next 2 days by his mother, Joan of Kent, the Chancellor, Archbishop Sudbury, Treasury, Sir Robert Hales, the Earls of Arundel, Salisbury, and Warwick, the young Earl of Oxford, and a small group of attendants and professional soldiers, which included Sir Robert Knowles, Robert of Namur, and Gascon Routier, Boudicat Albert. They were staying at the English court. The only organized bodies of troops in the capital were two small garrisons of the Tower, the Knights of the King and about 150 men-at-arms and an uncertain number of archers. There was also a band of retainers of Knowles, who he had stationed at his London mansion. Much depended upon the attitude of the mass of Londoners. This was extremely uncertain. The regressive character of the poll tax had been particularly jarring in the capital, with its stark contrast of wealth and poverty. The richer merchants, who had previously been assessed on the value of their stock and trade, got away with a few shillings for themselves and their immediate families. These men, who included the dominant figures in the guilds and the city government, were the main beneficiaries of the poll tax. They had driven forward the enrollment of taxpayers with energy, organizing house-to-house visits, which ensured the scale of evasion was lower than in most parts of the country. The anger of the undeclared taxpayers was found out so strong that the sheriffs of London and Middlesex refused to collect their names for fear of riots. It is, however, clear that a significant number of Londoners supported the rebel cause for reasons far more diverse than the poll tax. Some, mainly drawn from the poorest classes, sympathized with the grievances of the peasants and may have shared their utopian visions. Serfdom was not a problem in London, but relations between mass of laborers and journeymen was no easier for that. However, most of the peasants' supporters in the capital appear to have been motivated not by social grievances at all, but by the same political animosities which had provoked the disorders in London in 1376 and 1377. This was, for Londoners, unfinished business. The notion of a corrupt court betraying the country to the French, out for its own enrichment, had never died. So we'll continue with the Wat Tyler Revolution next time. Now, the sources for this: The Hundred Years' War, The Chronicles by Froissart, The Hundred Years' War by Perrois, The Hundred Years' War by Nylans, and The Hundred Years' War, The House Divided, Volume 3 by Sumption. So I hope you enjoyed that, and as always, don't forget to come by the website, summahistorica.com or historyaccordingtobob.com, and ask a question, leave a comment, check out our merchandise, and if you like what we're doing, please feel free to support us. Thank you very much.